Can you take this photo, please?
Excuse me, can you take this photo, please? Oi, douche, can you take this photo, please?
G'day, mate, can you take this photo, please?
Hey,
can you take this photo, please? Can you take this photo, please? With Justin Hamilton and Bronnie Robinson.
Welcome to the latest podcast of Can You Take This Photo, Please? My name's Justin Hamilton with Bronnie. Hey,
yeah,
Bron.
Hey, mate. How are you?
I'm good. I feel like I've let you down again.
I'm going to punch you so far up the fucking placard.
I'm just happy for the attention. I'm sorry about this. I caught up with Tony Martin again for a part two, because remember the last time we chatted to him?
Yes.
It was, what did we get up to? I think we got up to his career, like, I think he just started radio.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Such a great chat. And I know lots of people, you know, people love the podcast and people are writing such lovely things. You know, you can, of course, through our Facebook page and through my Twitter account and stuff like that. But so many people just say, hey, I love it, it's great. When are you having Tony back?
Yeah, we want more.
We want more Tony Martin. So I managed to catch up with him in the Vic Hotel again.
Awesome. Piano?
No piano.
Where is this bitch?
I don't know. Or maybe she did turn up. Like, Tony and I, like, we managed to record for an hour and we chatted for three and a half. So, you know. But it's fascinating stuff, and yeah. And he's such a great guy, and he's got really interesting stories, and you'll be happy to know that we still don't get to now, like we didn't even get to get this.
Oh Jesus!
So there's still more stuff to talk about. So have a listen, and we'll be back to wrap things up after a little bit of Tony Martin.
I'm back with Tony Martin in the Victoria Hotel, hoping that the old lady will arrive. I did a podcast here with Katrina Davidson from Brisbane, and I was telling her about the old lady that came and played, right. And it was like nice and beautiful in the background. But all we had was it was around Melbourne Cup time.
Oh, right.
So instead we had old people, you know, standing in the background yelling out, Gary, 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 Ike. He can't hear me. That's
we haven't even got that.
No, we've got
nothing. No.
There's something on the TV in the background.
Yeah. But I think a contagion has broken out, or is it the film?
That's all right. We'll record podcasts until everyone drops dead.
Okay.
So the last time we chatted, I think, what did we get to? We got to, like, the middle of the late show.
Yeah, I have to be really careful that I don't say the same things we've already said.
I think, the late show hadn't finished, and maybe you and Mick hadn't started radio, or maybe you had just started doing radio together.
When did we start? Well, we did a show called Bull Twang.
Right.
Which was a radio show we did in 1990 when the D-Generation Breakfast Show was still going. I know, 1990, it's so long ago. Were you in school?
I was my first year out.
Right, okay. Yeah. Well, this was a Sunday night show where we were just allowed to crap on, and we were up against the American Top 40 with Casey Kasem.
Right.
And I think we were the first show to beat American Top 40 in the ratings. But it only ran for 16 weeks, Bull Twang, but it caused, it won some awards, and it caused all this trouble because I had this, I did these prank phone calls, because I hate prank phone calls, and
do
I
you
would,
really? Because you do one of the classic ones, which is the, Will and I were listening to it, not that long ago, where you have to make the guy...
Oh, say shed?
Yes.
That's on one of our... But see, no one gets hurt in that.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's like a neutron bomb.
Yeah.
It's gone off, but no, there are no fatalities. I just find them so cruel. I always side with the victim on a gotcha call normally. But so we would just do weird ones. And on Bull Twang, the idea was I would call up people in my normal voice and claim to be a celebrity and see how long I could talk to them. And it's amazing how people would just go along with it.
Right.
And I'd call up someone and claim to be Barbara Streisand, just be talking in my normal voice and see how long the conversation would go for. And we did one where this was in the era of Salman Rushdie with his satanic verses when he was living in Bono's shed.
Yes.
And
that's when you know a fat bar's gone too far. When you have to live with Bono.
For 3.5 years. But at that time, no one knew where he was. And I called up the Iranian embassy and claimed to be Salman Rushdie and and that I was working in the handing out brochures for the pancake parlour in Bourke Street Mall. And you go, surely no one will buy this. Yeah. And the guy was like taking it deadly serious. It's like, what? You are what? Rushdie? You are where? Pancake? What? And it was like, and I went, oh no, he's taking this seriously. And I just went on and on, and it went, there were security guards in every Triple M in the country for about 4 months.
Really?
After that call, although nothing happened.
What about the pancake kids? Were they in trouble?
They were. Well, they thought it was a plug.
Free advertising.
They were happy with that. But yeah, so we did that show. But those calls got the show a lot of attention, and that was kind of the model for Martin Malloy. Years before we did it, and it also had Pete Smith in it. It had that was the first time we worked with Pete on radio, and I wrote a series of monologues for Pete called "The Inner Life of Mr. Copper Art," in which he just talked endlessly about philosophy and literature, and Pete just executed them superbly.
Yeah,
and so that show that we did in 1990, and then we just forgot about it, and we went off and did stand up, and we did The Late Show.
Yeah,
and after The Late Show, obviously half of the group went off and became Working Dog, and me and Mick just went on the road doing stand-up for a year and trying to get up Martin Malloy as a TV show. As a TV show. Back at Nine, who had rejected The Late Show, and foolishly we, please sir, can I have another? Yes. We went back and tried to get it up as a TV show, and I'm trying to remember what happened. That's right, David Lyle, who was the host of Golden Years of TV. He got us in, and he said, we want you to do a show that would be on when the footy show is on in the non-footy show months.
Right.
And we went, oh, that's too much pressure. We don't want to do a show then. We want to do a show at 11:30 at night on Fridays, and when we can really muck around. And so we started planning a pilot for that, and then 3 weeks before we were about to shoot it, David Lyle said, now I should let you know that we are going to screen this pilot. And we went, but that's not why you make a pilot. A pilot is an experiment to try things out. If you know it's going to be screened, you'll behave differently.
Yeah, and you'll film a pilot for it.
yeah, that's right, a pilot for the pilot. And we go, well, when are you going to screen it? And he goes, well, we thought we'd show it on a Thursday night at 9:30. And we went, right, okay, so that's what this is about. So we pulled out. And because what you would do at Thursday night at 9:30 is not what you would do at 11:30 on Friday night.
Yeah.
So then we, God. Is this too? Am I already being too boring?
No, stop it. Well, why did The Late Show finish? Were you guys just done? Because it'd been pretty full on for
The Late Show. There have been so many versions of why it finished. The main reason I think it finished was Mick Malloy got very sick of it early towards the end of it.
Right.
And I know it was as I may have explained to you, we went from earning, collectively, we were being paid $1 million to do the last year of the radio show. And I hope I mentioned in the last podcast, we put all that money into the show.
Yeah.
And put thousands and thousands of dollars of our own money into hundreds of thousands, in fact, into filming our own sketches. And then when we were doing The Late Show, we were being paid, I think we were being paid $30,000 a year. I think because we were being paid. That's right. We all got $1,500 an episode.
Wow!
And there were 20 episodes a year, and we didn't do anything else because that was the whole year. So it was definitely a step backwards. And Mick, if you remember The Late Show, Mick was kind of the breakout star of The Late Show. He was the one who had the most heat.
Yeah, yeah. Mick was the guy that you might know.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? Like he was also something that I think a lot of TV's lacking now. He was naughty. Do you know what I mean? Like the great Mick Malloy moments were him playing pool with Eddie Charlton and drinking a beer and making him run around the pool table with his pants down. So you knew that guy.
Well, Mick and Rob, I think, were the two stars of that show. But Rob had been around on D-Generation before, so people had seen him before. But there was definitely Mick was the hot.
Rob was also naughty, when he'd be getting interviewed by Gleisner, and he'd be, Imran Khan.
That's right.
you could see Gleisner trying to get onto the next question, yes. And he'd just keep undermining the moment.
And knowing that it's all going out live, so it can't be cut. It's not going to be cut. It's not going to be chopped out. And there was an element of having to fill the show up as well.
Yeah.
But I know towards the end there was you know, we were being not making any money, and I know Mick was getting huge offers to do things, and he got offered a tour with him and Russell Gilbert and Trev Marmalade. Went on this massive stand-up tour where they were playing like 10,000 seat arenas, I think, or something. Right. I'm probably exaggerating, but that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
And Mick kind of announced towards the end of the second series that he wouldn't be doing a third series. So that was really it. And I think we just went, well, we can't do a... There was a bit of discussion about whether we could do it without him.
And Judith joined you in the second season, didn't she?
She did, but I think Judith was always going to be in the show from the beginning, because she had been in our radio show in the last year of our radio show.
Right, yep.
But I think what happened there was we waited till year two before rolling Judith out, so to speak, because we just felt like we wanted to make a point with that cast. Like, we... Part of the reason... I think we were so angry about it being rejected at Channel 9.
Yeah.
It was like we really wanted to prove a point by getting it onto the ABC, and it was like, let's have those seven people. Let's have that cast.
Yeah.
And but then, of course, we realised early on that you couldn't do any sketches with two women if there was just Jane. The next choice was me dragging up.
Yeah.
And so in the second year, we brought Judith in. And there was a certain, I think, fans who hadn't heard the radio show, i.e. anyone not in Melbourne, sort of went, who's this interloper?
Yeah.
It was like Charles Winchester, you know, joining MASH for a while there. So Jude had a hard time. And but she had been, you know, friends with us. It wasn't like a gratuitous ring-in.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we were able to do sketches with two women in year two. And, and then there was no year three.
That's not necessarily a bad thing in... retrospect, because then when you go back and watch all of the episodes and watch stuff, it's,
oh my God,
it's pretty much quality all the way through.
We all live in terror that one day someone will show the uncut episodes with all the all the throwing to a clip and then 3 second gap before it comes in.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, it did have a pretty good strike rate, but it was ramshackle at the same time. I mean, we would get to Thursday night of the Saturday, of, you know, it's going to air in 2 nights from now, and the board would still have, you know, a quarter of an hour not filled.
Yeah, right.
And so, you know, I think if we had known that it would still be around 20 years later, we would have, you know, prepared even more.
But, you know, it's when I talk to people about stuff from the show, everyone brings up, you know, people bring up Shit Scared, people bring up... you know, Robert De Niro trying to be a waiter. You know, there's all this great stuff. What were the characters that, not Graham and the Colonel, but there were these kind of generic characters that Rob and Santo used to play?
Oh, there was Jeff and Terry.
Jeff and Terry.
And there was the Oz brothers who were...
Yeah, Jeff and Terry especially, you know, with their... You know, I think they were pilots for one sketch where Jane was trying to interview them. And
they were actually written for a live show we did at La Joke called The Midnight Shenanigans. That was a comedy festival show we did in 91, and they were just cladding salesmen, I think. And cladding might have been a new idea in 1991.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that was just... There was that sense of... With that show, there was... Because there was a lot of pre-recorded stuff, like you mentioned the Warren Perso sketch, you know, on the last one where you spend ages getting it right and editing it and it's very nutted out. The idea was to try and mess up the live part so you would get this contrast of sketches almost going off the rails, and then when you think it's crashed, bang, you whack in a really slick pre-recorded sketch.
Yeah,
so I was
trying
to get those two poles. And the other great thing we loved about The Late Show was you could do anything in it. You could do a fancy bit of acting if you wanted, or you could just go out in the street with a microphone and be yourself talking to people on the
you
street.
Guys,
it had very wide poles.
Yeah, you guys doing the chat, and then you'd go to the Mr. Whippy car race.
Yeah, there was no... There was really... Those two things were separate, I think, up until that point. There was a lot of sketch comedy. Then there were things like The Factory with Andrew Datto, where people, you know, piss fart around as themselves. But we wanted to try and get as many styles as we could under the one umbrella.
Yeah, right. So so that finishes, Mick goes on his tour.
Yeah, Mick went off on tour. I remember the show finished on Saturday night, and then on the Tuesday morning we found ourselves down at Santos Beach House. And it was like, right, who wants to do Frontline?
Oh, right.
It was like as quick as that.
Yeah.
And Rob and Jane and Tom and Santo had already started planning Frontline. And I think me and Judith, I can't remember if Jason was there. It was like, which gang do you want to be in?
Yeah, right.
And I was very, I guess, insecure. I was very, I don't think I'll be funny unless I'm with Mick Malloy. So I sort of, even though Mick was off touring with Russell and Trev.
Yeah.
And then after that was in, you would remember maybe, in Adelaide, he was in Accidental Death of an Anarchist, directed by Robin Archer.
At the
Fringe Festival. So he was off.
Wow, I'd forgotten about that.
Being massive. And I basically just went back to doing 10-minute spots at the ESPY.
Yeah, right.
And I remember at the end of the late show, I might have mentioned this in the last one, Mick and I, did you notice how I said Ed?
Yeah.
This used to happen with me and Mick, I would go, Tommy. Yeah. Always referring to my previous husband in comedy. Mick and I had made this pact, no matter how tough things got on the Late Show in terms of, you know, running out of material, we would never break into our stand-up.
Yeah.
We were like, we can go back to stand-up and back to that act. After the show, I think we might have busted out a couple of jokes, but you know, my big ambition at the end of the Late Show was to go back to stand up and do an hour. You know, that thing, remember when you first do an hour?
Yeah, it feels like a real accomplishment to stand on stage for an hour with a microphone and entertain.
Yeah,
it feels like a real achievement.
It's all builds toward, you know, it's 10, then it's 20, half an hour, 40, then an hour,
and then an hour.
And I'd only ever been Mr. 40 minutes, or maybe Mr. 50 minutes on a good night. I never hit the hour. So I just went back to just going down the ESPY and just whenever it was, Tuesday night, and running up new and dying in the arse.
Yeah, right.
And having people go. I remember at one point we won the Logies for best comedy in 1994 for the Late Show, and you know, I'm down at the ESPY doing new material and dying in the arse, and you can see people in the audience going, isn't that one of those Logie winning guys?
Yeah, what's happened? Well, why was it? Was it just dying because it was new material?
Just new material. Yeah. Just the old, you know, you go down with 15 minutes and you have 6 of gold, and then you have 9 of new, and of the 9 new, 4 will work and 5 will die. That seemed to be my formula.
Yeah, lots of ideas that you realise should have only been yours.
Yes. As Anthony Morgan used to say, a lot of sentences.
A lot of sentences.
Not jokes, just sentences.
Yeah.
And so I went and did that, and I went up to Sydney and did my first, I remember I did my first season on my own at the Paddington RSL, where it was my first time hitting an hour.
Yeah.
And then after that, after Accidental Death of an Anarchist had run its course, Mick came back, and we became a touring double act again. Toured with Judith for a while.
That's when I saw you guys, yeah.
And we just spent all of 94 just touring everywhere.
Yeah.
Doing the tour you're on at the moment.
Yeah.
But, and trying to get up Martin Malloy as a TV show and failing, and then scaling it back to a rate, and then reviving Bull Twang and going, you know, let's see if this can be a radio show.
Doesn't, in a way, that worked out well, because one of the key skills that you and Mick have is theatre of the mind.
Yeah, well,
do you know what I mean? Like, so being able to talk about stuff and make suggestions can make things pop even more than, you know, like some people's art is that they really can say, check this out. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
but you guys somehow would be able to find nuance in an advert and riff on that.
Well, we used to call it, a phrase I used to have for it was a jetpack show, in that, I mean, I love sound effects and music and all of the things you can do, all the theatre of the mind stuff. And I used to say that on Martin Malloy we were ourselves, and we would interview people, and it would be like normal people being themselves, and we would talk to callers. But then we might, in the middle of a segment, put on a jetpack and go over to the window and just fly away.
Yeah.
And you would just hear the sound of the jetpack going to the distance. Whereas if Eddie Maguire did that on the Grill Team, which was our opposition, it would just sound like he'd gone insane.
Yes.
And so It was always that thing. I guess we were very influenced by David Letterman's 1980s show, where he was a real person,
yeah.
but then he would say, "Here's what I did on the weekend," and you would cut to a sketch with him just in a little fake lounge room. That clearly wasn't his lounge room.
Yeah.
And so he could... But whereas if Johnny Carson did that, it would be odd, because he was too real.
Yeah.
So it's like, you want to be real enough that you can have a natural conversation, but you still want to be in a universe where
anything can happen.
Someone can, slam your plums with a sledgehammer.
Yeah, right.
and so you can still be a sketch comedy version of yourself. It's a hard thing to explain.
Yeah.
But we would...
Like, it's a facet of your personality.
Yeah. We just loved sound effects and mucking around, having things take a long time to happen.
Yeah.
I used to always say, you know, I remember... The most influential thing for me on radio was The Goon Show when I was a kid, and it taking someone a minute and a half to fall down a flight of stairs.
I used to
love that. And so we would love sound effects and things that would take, that would just sound like nothing else on radio.
Yeah. Was it a good fit, like, once you saw Frontline, did you look at that and think, you wanted to be a part of that, or...?
I don't think I would have been... I mean, there was always a slight tension in the group when Mick and I started doing stand-up, because it was always very much a group.
Right.
It was a big organism made up of a number of people.
So what was the tension? They didn't like you doing stand-up?
It just seemed odd. It's also a bigger thing than that, in that now everyone does a one-man show. In the early days of the Melbourne Comedy Festival, it was very odd, unless you were a huge name, Wendy Harmer. People would always do, you know, just an endless number of group shows.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be six of the best, and it would be Tim Smith and Andrew Goodwin and me and Nick. And it was very... I remember Tim Smith one day announcing he was going to do a one-man show, and it was really shocking. Everyone went, well, on your own?
Yeah.
And so there was a little bit like that in our group.
Right.
And that it was, you know... Mick and I were obsessed by the art of stand-up, and that was not something the rest of the group were interested in.
Right.
So it was kind of... It did seem very selfish that we were going off and doing a show on our own. And, I mean, what makes Working Dog work is a genuine collective. It's a genuine... It's four people all combining as in one voice.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how I would have gone in that group.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's, you know, I would have been trying to wedge in things that didn't fit. I mean, the thing about Frontline is very, you know, it's directed by four people. It's written by four people. And yet it's got a very singular
vision.
There's no one coming in and saying, let's have Mike Moore fly off on a jetpack.
No.
So I wonder how that would have gone. They certainly didn't need my help.
Frontline seems to have predicted where... TV was going to go as well now.
Yeah, it does seem, I mean,
like the parody seems to have become, like, you feel like someone on Channel 10 watched and went, oh no, that's how you do it.
Yeah, it's a pilot.
Yeah.
For Today Tonight. Oh, I know, it seems almost tame when you look at it now. Absolutely.
Rob's slightly lazy eye was one of the funniest things. Anytime he was being sincere, always just looking slightly lazy. And, it's great.
And Elliot Rhodes. I loved Elliot Rhodes, the Friday Night Funny Man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I loved... Relatives of mine were in the audience where... Remember when... I can't remember which episode. Maybe it was the one with Harry Shearer where they get in a studio audience. Someone goes, hey, Elliot Rhodes needs a studio audience. And nobody... And they're completely silent.
Yes.
No, that was... It was a great show, definitely.
So then you're at this point... So you're touring... when did you hook up with Mick again?
Well, in about... I think it was Comedy Festival 94.
Yeah.
We got back together and then just toured for the rest of the year. And toured everywhere.
Yeah.
But did it in a very... You know, normally... You know, I remember the Doug Anthony All-Stars, you'd hear they were doing... 58 shows in 60 nights.
Yes.
And that was like, we would do, you know, 7 shows or 7 nights and then have 2 weeks off. So it was very financially foolish, but it was more enjoyable to do it that way. And also we were being toured by Simon Morley, the man from Puppetry of the Penis. And
yes.
He wasn't the world's most organised man. He was great, though, for a touring...
And, you know, like if the car broke down, you could just make a wind sail and you could float there.
This was... That's true. Get together with Mr. Methane and, you know...
make it happen.
It's the future of transport. But the... yeah, he was... this was pre-puppetry of the penis. I think at that time, his brother... Justin Morley was the genius of puppetry of the penis.
Yeah, right.
Jamoan had some connection to it. There was always Jamoan always seemed to be part of it in the early days.
Yeah, right. But with his pants on.
I think so.
Yeah,
he was doing the act within the pant.
So when did the radio show start?
It started at the around the beginning of 95.
Yeah.
It ran 95 to 98.
To 98.
Those were the 4 years. Yeah.
How did you work together? How did you write together?
Well, I think I might have mentioned this in the last one, but we, on the Late Show, because the director needed to know everything we were going to say, we would have to rehearse, we would have to hear what each other's lines were. So when we did those opening monologues, Mick and I were acting that we didn't know what the other one was about to say. It was a script we were following. And
it seemed to a lot of your reactions. We did talk about this, and I went back and looked at some stuff. And the reactions often are you're looking at the audience, and it's almost like you're getting the enjoyment out of the audience than out of each other. And that makes sense in hindsight because you knew the line.
Well, that was it. And you were always looking for an add-on to add a little extra bit in.
Yeah,
but it's the same. I just did the show with Ed, Joy of Sets, and we, on that show, it was all scripted, but we wouldn't tell each other what we were going to say. So we would, again, I think I mentioned this last time, we'd do the blah blah rehearsal, where you would just say, and in 1967 this show went out, blah 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 blah.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't say the joke until the audience were in front, and we wouldn't look at each other's clips.
Yeah.
So Ed would have clips, I would have clips, and when his, in the rehearsal, when his clips are playing, I'm literally going blah, you know, covering my ears and going, not listening, to try and get a natural reaction when you do it. But on radio, I remember there were a lot of shows that were filled with fake laughter.
Yeah.
And we just didn't want that. So we would write, we had a shed on the top of the building, which they had.
Is that real?
Yeah, it wasn't because we wanted a shed. It was just because there was no room. Triple M and Fox FM had been taken over by, I guess, became Austereo. So there were two stations operating out of one building.
Right.
And there just wasn't room for us. And I think we were going to go down to MCM Studios in St Kilda Road. And the Brad March, the program director, was worried what would happen if we left the building.
Right.
So they craned a workman's shed up onto the roof of Fox FM. And that's where we worked for 4 years in this tiny box.
That shed is almost mythical.
Well, I think the Crud guys took it over after we left. Found a lot of our old bad jokes in there.
Yeah.
But a lot of references to things. What was the Whiskey or Go-Go bombings? We don't remember that. But we were in this tiny shed, and we were like two guys hiding each other's homework. We would get in, and I'd go, I've got something on this, have you got something on that? Okay, I'll do this, I'll do that. And then when we wanted to rehearse, we would go outside the shed and talk to ourselves.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it was very close. But I think for 4 years, I don't think we collaborated on anything genuinely.
Right.
Lately, I can't remember a time in 4 years where we sat down and wrote something together.
Yeah.
Like, we would write separately and then fill in the blank. Or often we would do a topic. It would be one topic, and I'd go, well, I've got something on that guy and that bit. And then, have you got something on the middle bit? Yeah, you do that.
Yeah.
And so, and we'd sit there reading. I mean, because every now and then Martin Malloy got so successful, there would always be someone would come in, including Mark Holden on one occasion. He was one of about 20 people over the 4 years who would come in and pitch, I've got an idea, why don't we do a TV show of this?
Right.
We can simulcast it. And then they'd sit in on the show, and you could see them realising it wasn't going to work. When they're just two guys sitting there with Spirex notebooks reading out material and making it sound like it's, you know, being an improvised.
Right.
But, yeah, it was...
Did it feel like fun? Like, did you feel like you were achieving something really special at the time? Because I kind of sometimes wonder if, you know, one of the things that we're not very good at is enjoying the moment and on being aware of the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. We were just so busy. That's what I remember. And very much the same on Get This, where you you know, I don't have any kids, so I can afford to devote. I can afford to have my eyes snap open in the morning and go, well, what's the opening break?
Yeah.
And then just spend all day watching clips. And because we didn't have any other writers, it was down to us to do everything. It wasn't very enjoyable. It was 4 years of constantly being worried you wouldn't have enough for tomorrow's show.
Yeah.
And sketches. You know, we did a lot of sketches, and I would write a sketch one day. It was very democratic. It was 50-50.
Yeah.
I would write a sketch one day. Mick would do a sketch the next day. And it was just... Yeah. It was fun. This is a cliche you hear, but the most fun was when you're actually doing the show.
Yeah.
Well, that was the most relaxing because you weren't having to write for that bit.
Yeah. It's happening. There's nothing you can do about it. You can't second guess it.
No. It was actually quite relaxing sitting there during the songs.
Yes.
Not having to work for a few moments.
Why did the show finish? Was it just after 4 years you were done?
We just had run out of... I think we got, a lot of heat because we put out a press release saying that we were knackered. That was the word. I remember there was a headline. They're knackered was the headline. And it was... at the very height of its popularity, and people were quite angry. I remember there were a lot of people, why can't you just keep going forever? And
4 years is a long time to be churning out a lot of stuff.
But it hadn't, the decline hadn't yet begun, and
that's a skill. Like, knowing when to get out is so, so important.
I wish we could say it was for that kind of noble reason, but it was just exhaustion. It was just like, the sword fight at the end of The Four Musketeers with Michael York and Christopher Lee when they can barely lift their swords to fight.
Yeah.
It was like the tink, tink. Is there any more Pauline Hanson material? I can't remember. That was it. Yeah, so it was the end of 98 when Eat Your Peas came out. That was the last thing we did,
You know, I had a young guy... asked me to sign a copy of that, and I remember saying to him, I had nothing to do with this CD. And he said, yeah. And so there is a signed copy of Eat Your Peas with my signature on it. Hopefully, if anyone is to look at it, they would find the most ironic signature.
I love things that are signed by the wrong people. One of my great, I remember Dave Graney brought me because we were obsessed on Get This with Nick Kershaw.
Yeah.
He found a 45 of Wide Boy by Nick Kershaw, and he got Robin Hitchcock to sign it.
Right.
So I have a copy of Wide Boy by Nick Kershaw signed by Robin Hitchcock. It's such a cool thing
Funny. Have you gone back and listened to any of that stuff in recent years?
Martin Malloy? No, I haven't.
Yeah.
I don't know why, because I would like this. Occasionally I'll think of an idea and I'll go, did I do that 10 years ago?
Yeah.
And it's hard to find because all the shows exist on individual VHS cassettes, believe it or not.
Wow.
Because VHS was really good sound quality in the 90s. So we, I always remember when we started doing Martin Malloy, nobody kept their shows. Like every show had five VHSs that they would recycle Monday to Friday.
Right.
And we, after the first 3 weeks when we weren't keeping the shows, we were like, so much gold is disappearing. And we were so mocked by the radio people at the radio station because we went, we want to keep every show on an individual cassette. And it was like considered incredibly vain and ridiculous. And we were like, our cupboard that was filling with tapes was mocked. But then when we went on holiday for 2 weeks and we were able to put together best ofs to go for those 2 weeks, suddenly you could feel the whole station going, hang on a second, and suddenly every show was taping every episode.
Yeah.
And now, of course, you know, you can store anything on one of these iPods.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like I say this hoping that I'm not opening up a massive can of worms, but would you ever consider releasing them again, or...?
Well, I don't know. It was... the albums, I mean, I'm happy with the three albums we did, but they were very frustrating to do because...
Yeah.
We couldn't put a lot of the funniest stuff on because, again, it's like with The Late Show when, you're using clips from movies. You can't license it. And so much of Martin Malloy was using tapes of people's voices or a bit of music from a film or something.
Yeah.
And you can't, we can never put out Blimpy the Lactose Intolerant Cat in the Titanic because we can't get, who can afford that song from the Titanic?
Yes.
So there are so many, you know, there are so, you could, if copyright laws were to disappear, I could do a fantastic album.
Yeah.
But it would require, I mean, I have, I actually do have, I was very diligent about making cassettes of all of the best bits of the show. So every night when I would log the show and put all the best bits, even sometimes just a 10-second bit, onto a cassette, and that was what we made the albums from, because you, right, you could never listen back to every single show you did.
Yeah.
And I still have 180 90-minute cassettes that constitute the best of the show.
Wow.
And I'm going, even just to listen to 180 90-minute cassettes, that's several months.
Yeah, yeah.
I think even if you're, you know, even if you're listening to them back to back.
Well, that's why when I started saying it, I was like, well, I should just kind of put it out here. Maybe I shouldn't suggest this, but.
But I'm it would be an intriguing exercise to do. We were always going to. I remember for years, Mushroom were going to put out the three albums as a gift pack. And yep, they said, can you do a bonus album? We were always going to do a fourth album called The Spare Dick. And yep, so there were several years where we would remember something that wasn't on the album, going, that could be on The Spare Dick.
Yes.
But The Spare Dick never happens, sadly. Right.
It could be, you know, it could be something to put out be, yeah, under, you know, you, like, the great thing is you don't have to...
podcasts or something.
Yeah, or you be, can just go through, what is it? Is it, just drawing a blank on the name, Auto-Tune or something like that. Right. You could just actually release it yourself.
Yeah, well, we probably could.
Yeah, that'd be. I think there'd be people who would be pretty mad for it.
Well, I don't know where you go to find these things, but I'm told that someone has started archiving the whole episodes, which they must have taped themselves on,
yeah, right,
cassette.
Yeah.
So people are tracking them down.
They're keen for it.
Yeah.
And so what happens at the end of 98? What do you do from there? When did your first book come out?
Oh, that was 2004. No, what? Right? At the end of 98, that's right, I wanted to write longer stuff. I had this revelation that the Warren Burso sketch was the longest thing I'd ever written. And right, so my goal was to learn how to write a half hour for television. That was the project I set myself. And Mick was off doing the Mick Molloy show, setting, yep, that up. And I wrote two episodes of Leno and Woodley. But I didn't, I was so unconfident that I didn't actually, I wasn't officially employed to do that. I, right, remember, but they were doing Leno and Woodley, I still think one of the greatest comedy shows ever. The 13 half hours they did.
Yeah.
It was massively popular overseas, and because it's got that Mr. Bean thing of being visual, and yeah, so it can sell to a lot of countries. And they were going to do a third and fourth series back-to-back of, right, Leno and Woodley, 13 more episodes, and I think Colin and Frank were going to write the first six, and then for the first time they were going to let other people write episodes, and I can't remember, I think Matt Quatermain might have been writing one, but various people were writing them, and I bumped into Cole one day and I said, I'd like to write an episode, and he said, well, do you want to be contracted? And I just went, no, look, I'd like to try and write it first and see that it's good enough.
Yeah.
And so I wrote two episodes, and it took me 3 or 4 months to just get the hang of, I mean, it was the first time I'd written in someone else's voice. Like, yeah, I'd be driving around the block in my car talking as Cole, and it's Frank, and, yeah, just to having imaginary conversations, trying to do their voices
and get
the rhythm of it.
Yeah.
And I loved it, and it was such a great show, and I was really happy with one of the two scripts.
Yeah.
And then what happened was I got dragooned into the Mick Molloy show because Trev Marmalade pulled out about a week before it went to air.
Right.
And then after the first episode went to air, Roz Hammond quit the show. So the cast was diminishing.
Right.
And so I was only ever going to be a guest on the first show, but then I came in to make up the numbers. And then I think it was the week of show 5, I went to Edinburgh with Judith Lucy. And
yep,
Judith, who was determined to get me back into stand-up, because I hadn't done stand-up for the whole 4 years we did Martin Molloy, so I'd,
yeah,
kind of... Four years, a long time not to do stand-up, so I just felt like time had passed me by. But Jude was determined to get me into it off-Broadway. So she said, come to Edinburgh and be my support act, which is weird because no one ever has a support act in Edinburgh. You've got your valuable hour to fill.
Yes, and, you know, there's so many shows sandwiched around you that you are actually taking away valuable time. How long were you doing?
Well, she somehow had a 90-minute spot, so I got to do about 15, 20 at the top, and then I wasn't on the poster or anything.
Yeah.
And so I did that, and then...
Was that fun?
That was great fun, because it was the first time where I was doing stand-up where no one knew who I was. So the material was totally judged on just on the jokes.
And it's freeing.
And that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really... It was liberating. No one was yelling out, where's Wally? No one was yelling out, where's Mick, or do shit scared.
But also, even in a gig that sometimes what you discover when you go overseas is you don't have the preconceptions of the audience, but you also don't have your own preconceptions that you don't realise that you have.
No, and if you die, which I did, you know, one out of three nights I would go badly... No one knows who I am, so it wasn't as traumatic and embarrassing.
Yeah. It's stuck on Jude.
That's right, it's her fault. But it was, so that was, so then the festival ended, I always remember this, I got this terrible flu and I had to stay in Edinburgh for a week after the festival. I don't know if you've ever been there after the festival's finished.
I used to live in Adelaide. So I'd be there after the fringe, and it's like, it's a ghost town, and all the vibrancy and the colour and everything just disappears.
And also, you're like a millionaire, because suddenly the prices drop. Suddenly something that was a pound costs 25p, and you're going, oh, I see what they're up to. And so I was stuck there.
All the Scottish people return.
Yeah, I know, and you don't want to make a cliche about their money. But man alive, suddenly it was like being a giant in Tiny Town all of a sudden. But I always remember I was so sick and I couldn't get out of bed, and the phone rang, and it was, I can't remember who rang first, but I think it was Mick, and he goes, we've been axed. So I went, oh well, I've still got that job on Leno and Woodley. And then the phone rang and it was Colin going, we've been axed.
Oh,
so
no.
I think I lost two jobs in 1 hour on the other side of the world.
And with
With the flu. And Lane Ormoodley criminally never got to do series 3 or 4. So those scripts never sort of went anywhere. But that was kind of a stepping stone to trying to write a film, was writing something that made sense for half an hour.
Did you teach yourself to write scripts, or did you do any courses or anything? Or?
No, and I just wrote a lot of bad, like everyone, just blundered my way through. I spent most of the 90s writing a film script that I found recently. It was just awful. But, you know,
it's really hard finding stuff, isn't it, when you look and you think, I know this did the job for me to get where I am.
Yeah.
I found a script to a solo show that I'd written when I was in the duo, and it is diabolical. But within the morass of regret, there are little kernels that I go, oh, I can see where that turned into something else.
And you need that stepping stone.
You do.
To get there.
I think that's hard for the kids today. You know,
it is.
They're on YouTube, you know, after their first gig, and it's out there.
And they're all out planking till all hours.
Yeah, exactly.
The young people.
I'm so glad that none of that stuff was seen, and there's no record of it.
Oh my God, that's the thing now, is everything is...
It's there. You know, I've seen guys put up gigs where they've been heckled.
Oh my
God. They've been heckled, and their gig's been ruined. And this one in particular that I'm thinking of, the guy that put it up, the only reason I know about it is because I got up after him and then tore the heckler a new asshole.
Right.
But it's, you know, why would you put that up?
I don't know. Like, is it just
try to forget it. Yeah, shake it off.
Move on. Delete.
Yeah, delete. No one else needs to see it either.
No. Well, yeah, I'm glad there wasn't YouTube when I was starting out. My God.
Yeah, it's a horrifying prospect. You lost the two jobs in an hour.
Lost the two jobs in an hour, but I had got the bug to do stand-up again, and then I came back, and I had been, I think I wrote about this in one of my books, I was, the whole 3 weeks I was in Edinburgh, I was dizzy on stage. I just had this dizziness. It turned out to be an ear infection that, you know how your head is like a spirit level?
Yeah.
And if your ears go out of whack, the liquid in your ears goes out of whack. So I was just dizzy the whole time, and I went and had all these medical tests. Turns out I had this thing, hemochromatosis, this iron storing disorder, But it's that it's that thing where you go, oh no, I've got a terrible illness. Wow, is there a comedy festival show in this?
Yeah.
Can I be the Iron Man? So then I did my first solo comedy festival show in the year 2000, and that was the ending of that was all about being, this is what the Iron Man looks like. So yeah, that was my first, yeah, solo comedy festival show. And
you enjoyed it? You had fun,
yeah,
with it?
Yeah, I did it at the ESP. I was sandwiched in between Crazy E.
Yes, Crazy
and
E.
And Pommy Johnson.
Goodness.
That was the meat and the Pommy Crazy sandwich.
Wow.
And, yeah, so I did that. And, yeah, that was, I was one of the Barry nominees, but I think that was the year the Boosh won.
Yes.
And it was the same year Alan Breaux and Greg Fleet did Interrogation. That was another one of the nominees that year.
I remember seeing, I remember talking to Alan about this, where they did it in Adelaide and it struggled, and then they realised what they needed to do was they had to come out and explain what it was as a two-hander.
right.
And then in Melbourne it popped. Yeah. Everyone went, oh, okay, that's what they're doing.
It was pretty good.
I love the idea that, you know, those guys were so established that they had to come out and just go, this is how this show's going to work. And people just went, oh, okay. But if they just did the show almost like there wasn't enough of Vegas.
No.
We always like these guys.
But why isn't Fleety doing the Banjo Shark? What's wrong with the man?
What is happening?
But, yeah, so that was my... Yeah, that was 2000. Where are we up to on the running time?
We're doing fine. We're going well. And so were you writing Bad Eggs at this point?
No, I spent the rest of 2000. I went and rented a flat with nothing in it, with no internet, with nothing, and just went there for 4.5 hours a day. And I wrote a film script called Corner Pocket, which I spent nearly a year writing. And it's one of those things where, have you ever had this happen to you, where you do something and your friends have to have an intervention to tell you it's not as good as you think it is?
I feel like my career's been like that at times. No, not quite yet, but I have seen things where there's been the, you know, the disappointment in, you know, a loved one's eyes is awesome.
Right, where they use the word interesting.
Yeah, interesting. How do you think this is going?
It's interesting, yeah. Well, no, I spent all this time writing this film that I thought was brilliant, and it has good stuff in it, but it's three movies trying to be one film, and it has an ending that doesn't work, and I had a bunch of people take me aside, including Alan Hardy, Marie Cardi's dad.
Right.
He said, look, I think this could be a disaster if you make it. I remember I showed it to Rob Sitch, and I remember he called me in to talk about the script, and I could see he'd written, there was so much writing on every page of the screenplay.
Oh.
There was like more notes than there were actual words in the script. And he sort of, I could tell he was breaking the news to me that it wasn't that good.
Oh,
and
no.
Then I said, oh, can I have that script back? And then I, he goes, oh, and he distracted me and took me out to the shredding machine and stood there talking to me about something like the weather while he just fed the pages into a shredding machine. And I just went, it was like, that was like a full stop on the, but then you go, oh my God, I've wasted a year of my life.
Right.
And
which you haven't, because it's the right, because you've been
it's
writing.
It's the learning curve.
It's the learning curve.
But
I've got to be honest, that is a phenomenal comedic image. Rob Sitch shredding a script while talking to you, keeping you distracted.
Distracted from reading any of the notes.
That feels like the greatest comedy image that we've never seen. Like,
well, he was doing me a favour, and
was he kind of embarrassed while he was doing it?
I think
it, or
was he? It was like it's a big. I mean, people listening would know it's a big ask to ask someone to read your film script.
Yeah,
because you have to be honest.
Yeah,
you can't. It's not like, should I do this joke? Yeah, give it a try. It's like, should I make this film? You're going to spend 3 years of your life making this film.
Yeah.
You have to be honest with people. So it's a big ask.
So was the mistake just that it was three films trying to be one?
Yeah,
or?
it was too much crammed into the suitcase.
Right.
But it has good stuff. It does have good bit. I dragged it out recently. It's got the first time script mistake of having too much expositional dialogue, but it has some very good lines from Bob Franklin.
Oh, right.
I got to write in Bob's voice. That was fun.
It was a could you extract them and make good movies?
I might be able to, although it's bizarre because two of the subplots have subsequently been done as other films. I won't say what they are because I may want to revive them, and both of those films were failures. So that was like an interesting lesson. Not that they were stolen, it was just somebody, people stumbled across the You know, it's great when you see someone else doing your idea and you go, how's this going to go? Yeah. Oh, my God.
Wow, I dodged the bullet.
It's not even going to be on their IMDb page.
Wow.
But then what happened was I had an opportunity to write, to get private money to make a film if I could write a genre film. So that's what Bad Eggs was. It was a genre movie, but an Australian version of a genre movie.
Yeah.
So I got... That was
chockers full of some great Australian comedy talent.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of problems with it. It's very hard for... I don't like to talk critically of it because I don't want to sound like I'm slagging the work of the people who did... You know, I would put the cinematography and the sound and the costume design and production design and the editing up against anything, the music... up against any Australian film, but so if I'm criticising it, I'm only criticising the writer and the director.
Yeah,
but yeah, I think
you don't want to be all Shia LaBeouf about it.
No,
he just goes around ragging on every film that he's ever made.
I know, and you go, maybe get a few more good ones under your belt before you... Weren't you the Transformers and Eagle Eye guy?
Yeah.
Were you in The Conversation or Blue Velvet? No, I don't think you were.
No, you were the guy that showed potential in a movie where you weren't important.
No, that's right. The punching robots were doing better.
Now he rags on all the movies he's in while picking fights with Frankie Muntz. That's a career.
No, well done. Well done, Mr. LaBeouf.
But the, you know, it's always hard to look at anything that you've done. Like, I've made a decision that I don't want to film any of my shows. Because they, you know, I think it was Louis C.K. when he came out and he was defending Tracy Morgan earlier this year.
Who had said
some stuff that was considered homophobic, etc. Mm. And there seemed to be a lot of decisions made and a lot of thought processes that were all based on no one having been there.
And
Louis C.K. sort of said, you know, and this really struck a chord with me, that, you know, comedy works when you're in the room at this precise moment with these people, with this energy. So who knows exactly what the context was?
That's
because
right.
No one else was there except those people. Yeah. And it made me realise that even there's very few stand-up DVDs that I thoroughly enjoy. They always do feel a little bit removed. And
I like the... I'd rather hear an album. I'll often, you know, like Patton Oswalt will put out a show as a DVD and an album, and I'll always buy the album. I love listening to stand-up as an audio thing.
Yeah, but also going back and looking at stuff is... I can't bear it, because all I do is see, you know, like, the imperfections of the memory are glorious, but the watching the imperfections or the mistakes... I find really disappointing.
And also often it's just been recorded with the mic at the back of the room and it's all echoey and nothing, no joke sounds good in that.
My management did a whole lot of DVDs with a lot of their clients, and I, for whatever reason, missed out. And at the time I was quite fucked off. I was a little bit like, I started getting indignant and then a bit like, well, you know, I've won awards. Like, you know, why am I? And then after a while I thought, oh God, well, I'd be horrified at the stuff because, you know, I wouldn't be able to watch it. And then, you know, you'd have people watching, and I always feel like the live process is where
happens. We were talking before about the Paul F. Tompkins impersonal album where he just went, all this material I've done for 20 years has never been taped.
Yeah.
So he just relearned it all and did a one-off.
I find that fascinating.
Would that be something you would do?
I don't know. I would have to find a new way in. Do you know what I mean? You'd have to find a new way to make it work again. Like
it's like Fleety doing tie-dye.
Yeah, well, just a couple of days ago.
And just shooting it once. You're going, wow, that's a big...
That's balls of steel to me.
Yeah, it sure is.
But that's why that show has become... We've been talking before. That show has become so big in my imagination that Like, I'm sure it's still brilliant, and I'm sure Fleety's still brilliant, but I don't know if it can reach the height that it is
in
my head.
Right.
You know, it's almost like seeing the film footage of that was taken out of Star Wars, of Jabba the Hutt.
You seen it?
Yeah.
What does he look like?
He's just some dude who likes tacos, you know? And it's like, it was... But, you know, reading about it, it was such a big mythical
Yeah, the custard pie fight from the end of Doctor Strangelove. You never want to see it.
You never want to see it.
It's got such a mystique about it.
But yeah, but you hear people who said, you know, the reason it was cut was because it didn't work.
Yeah, that's right.
There's a reason it's gone.
That's right.
So I can imagine watching a movie that you've written and directed, no matter how good everything is around it, it would be hard not to be sitting there.
Yeah, I just see are problems. Yeah. But I don't have any problems with anyone's work in it. I think everyone did amazing work in it, and they were just doing what I told them to do.
How do you direct friends? Is that a hard thing?
That's interesting. People need confidence boosting. They want you to be the safety net. So I don't think I had any problems in that regard.
I found you as director on the librarian completely accessible. Do you know what I mean? Like, I found every kind of scene, every suggestion that you made always came from, like, it always felt like a really good place.
Yeah, it's a collaboration, and you want people to, you know, these are cliches, I know, but you want people to feel like they can try anything and not be embarrassed if it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And that's what the worst thing with acting is, when you're frightened to try something because you think you might make a fool of yourself.
Yeah.
And people making fools of themselves is often some of the best stuff. You know, we're talking about Dr. Strangelove. You know, I know George C. Scott, you often used to see interviews with him where he couldn't watch that film because Kubrick had used all the takes where he just kept pushing him and pushing him to the point where he goes, just try this, it may not work. Take 156, try this mad idea, like when he goes vroom, you know, that thing about flying in low.
Yeah.
It's some mad take that he's just done, and Kubrick has been the safety net for him and has said, look, I won't use it if it's not going to work, but just try this mad idea. And you know, the bit where George C. Scott falls over in the war room and then just gets up and continues.
Yeah.
You just want, the director's job is to allow things like that to happen. And if they don't work, to make sure the footage is destroyed.
Yeah, and never be spoken of again.
Yeah, but you very much, you're the arm round the shoulder.
Yeah. Would you make another film?
I'd love to, but I doubt whether I would get the... I mean, I put a lot of my own money into Bad Eggs. That was one of the reasons I got to direct it, because I was one of the investors, and I don't know whether I'd be able to afford to do that again. But it was interesting, because I think the main problem with that film, if there is one, if there has to be one, is that I was a certain timidity on my part, a certain worry that it's all... I was too worried about fucking up. I was too cautious in many ways.
Right.
And we didn't have time to do a lot of takes, and whereas then the next thing I did like that, which was the Boytown Confidential, which we would need a whole podcast in itself to talk about, but that was the exact opposite. That was something where it was made so cheaply with a two-man crew. There was no... I was given the goalposts of, look, it can be 10 minutes, it can be 200 minutes, it can be whichever or anywhere in between. If it doesn't work, because it's impro, well, we won't use any of it.
Yeah.
So that was like the ultimate safety net. So, and it was entirely improvised, and it was just incredibly freeing.
Yeah.
And now what I would love to do is combine the two, is to have the thought out organizedness of Bad Eggs with the messy impro-ness of the other one.
Yeah.
I don't know whether there would be any interest in me doing that, but if I was to do another one, that's what I would do.
That's how you'd
approach it. I would try
it.
And I go, okay, now I know what to do.
Yeah.
Now,
right.
I think I don't think I really knew how to direct actors very well when we were doing Bad Eggs, and I actually learned a huge amount just doing impro with people.
Right.
Yeah.
How does that change from... I shall just check out timing here. With writing a script for a movie, writing your book, how did that... was that a Because I feel like we have a similar sense of, you know, we could keep noodling stuff forever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the book wasn't meant to be a book. So that was another thing where I didn't feel the pressure of writing a book, because I'd tried to write a couple of novels and using true real life material as novels. I had this huge lesson years ago, which is people often think because something happened, therefore it's interesting and funny.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing the film The Crake, Jim Owens' film The Crake, and there's some great stuff in that film. Bob Franklin and Colin Hay make me laugh.
Yeah.
And
Bob Franklin is like the epitome of the cool comedian. You know what I mean? Like, he's just cool.
That's right.
Yeah.
Almost everything he says is amusing.
Even an aside, like, you know.
Just him ordering a drink.
Yeah. I wish I could order a drink like that.
But with this, I remember that I saw Jim Owen on the panel about a week after the film came out. And he described something that happens in the film, and he said, this really happened. And he had the audience in stitches describing how either he or some people he knew were illegal immigrants, and two Mormons came to the door in suits, and they thought it was the immigration department.
Yeah.
So these guys who were nude just got up and ran up the street. And it was hilarious the way he described it, because it had really happened. When you see it in the movie, it's filmed with Dutch angles.
Yeah.
It's sort of... It doesn't feel like something that's really happened.
Yeah.
And so I went, why is it I laugh when Jim Owen tells that story? I don't laugh when I see it acted out in the film. And so there's... I think there was a bit of that with the novels. Like, just because these things really happen doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to be that... have that power in a fictional context. So I was... The example I always use is the woman in one of the stories in Lolly Scramble who wants to try and trap a man who's been seen several times masturbating in the laundry.
Yes.
And so she buys 22 air horns, you know, those really loud air horns, and goes around and gives one to everyone in every flat. So the idea is when you go down to the laundry, take the horn, and then if the guy's there, fire the horn off, and then everyone will come down, and I think I say, presumably, he'll be taken away to the body corporate's wicker man.
Yeah.
And that's a funny story when you know it really happened.
Yeah.
Now, when you now just put that in a novel, it's not that funny. It's something that someone might make up.
Yeah.
So part of the power of that is knowing that somebody really did do that.
Yeah.
So just as an exercise, I decided to write some of that material up as just reportage. Is that a word? Or is it reportage?
I don't know. I'll accept either.
So just write it up as, here's what really happened. And so I did one, and then I did another one, and I did some more, and then I gave them to a friend of mine who was a book editor to read, and her husband happened to be Andy Griffiths, man whose bum went psycho.
Yes.
And he read them and called me up and said, can I send them to my publishers? And so, slowly but surely, it became a book.
Yeah.
But it wasn't intended to be one. When I was writing it, I started writing them, I was just writing them for myself.
Yeah.
So, there wasn't that pressure.
Turned out there was a market for it.
Yeah, yeah. It's still in print, that one.
That's always a moment of success, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, we should finish up because we're at the end, but we still some great stuff.
Oh, God.
We got to touch on the great Richard Marsland at some point.
Oh, we do. We're going to have to do a third one of these.
Yeah, turn it into
a bit indulgent.
Turn it into a triptych, bring in the Ewoks. Really?
Oh, my God.
We'll do a musical number at the end.
I'm really keen to see this Jabba footage because I just watched the Blu-ray of Star Wars.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's full of tinkering.
Yeah, it's chockers.
Full of... And you can see in that scene with Harrison Ford talking to Jabba.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how expensive the effects are, you never buy that their eye lines are meeting.
It's not happening.
It just doesn't look like he's looking at Jabba.
You know, I'm looking forward to that point in time when George Lucas is no longer with us, and I don't mean that in a good way, but then someone decides to remake the movies. And hopefully remakes them the original way that they were seen.
That's right.
The ultimate postmodern Star Wars extravaganza.
Where you can sort of see the mirrors underneath the landspeeder.
Yeah. I like the mirrors.
I love the mirrors. You know, my favourite thing in the... The best thing in the... what do we call them? Prequels.
Yeah.
Is the last 10 minutes of the last one where the production values kind of go back towards... Star Wars,
right.
the corridor where the bottom of the wall doesn't quite hit the floor.
Hit the floor, right.
Because he's obviously gone, man, people who watch this now in order are going to go, why is it in episode 4 does it suddenly look like Doctor Who?
Yeah.
So he's gone, we'll have to smooth that join by having the sets kind of go back to old school.
Wow.
I love that.
Well, I look forward to...
yeah, we'll have to come back here again.
We'll start tinkering with these interviews.
There you go. He's great. Man,
he is great. Next time, I'm there.
You've got to just come and hang out. He's such an interesting cat. And, you know, it's just early on. Oh, no. Am I boring? It's like, no, not at all.
Do you know who you are, dude?
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes I'm sitting there, you know, and you have to kind of remember.
Oh, that's right.
He jumped up at that room that we were running, the shelf. Right. Which was, for people who don't know, was a room on Monday nights at the Toff in Melbourne. We just did a four-week run, we're just doing small runs, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and that was our first season. And Tony came along and said, at the last break, said, hey, do you mind if I get up and sing a song? And I was like, what? No. And so he got up and we finished the whole season with him singing to Downtown, to the music of Downtown, but he changed it to Snowtown. And it was glorious.
That is awesome.
It was glorious. And I was with Gatesy and Tony and his girlfriend, and we'd had a few drinks, and it was late. And I said to him, you know what, if my 17-year-old self could see me right now, he would come up and punch me in the throat. He'd be so fucking jealous. I was loving it.
I'm going to punch you in the throat right now.
Yeah, I know. I shouldn't have put that idea into your head. Well, it's great. We'll be able to bring Tony back sometime in the future. So now you can get back to emailing me. So when's the third part going to happen with Tony? trust me, as soon as I can get an opportunity, we'll bring him back. But go to our Facebook page and like us there and send us messages. We're mad for it. And it's always good to hear from you. But yes, Tony Martin. I love him.
Oh, me too.
Bron, always great to see you.
You too.
And I'll just walk over here so you can really let loose with a haymaker.
Awesome.